By now he had no pigment in his skin to combat the harsh rays of the sun, and his face was almost scarlet, the scars that crisscrossed his countenance standing out lividly. His arms were red and raw. The amount of sun he was absorbing was making him susceptible to sunstroke, and he was swaying dangerously as they stood still. Mildred had some sunblock, originally designed for desert maneuvers by the pre-dark military, that she had taken from the redoubt, and she offered one of the tubes to Jack.
Do no good.
It's all there is.
She watched as he applied some of the cream to his raw skin. They had all used the block, but she had saved extra for Jack, only too aware of the problems he had because of his albino condition. Ryan noted the concern in her voice.
How much of that do we have left?
Not enough. Maybe 2-3 days' worth. It's like the water and the self-heats. This damn sun is making us use more than we could have estimated.
Ryan nodded, but said nothing. It was a cause for some concern that all their supplies, taken from a rich source, were being used far too fast. He squinted his good eye and took a long, hard look down the road in the direction in which they would travel. The horizon shimmered, but even in the haze, there was little sign of even a hallucination that could be construed as shelter.
There must be something here.
They spent the rest of the day making slow, agonizing progress along the old blacktop. The surface was too broken and scarred to use. The uneven tarmac could cause a sprained ankle or worse, and the sticky, almost melting surface would slow progress and take too much energy as it dragged and pulled at their aching leg muscles. The sun, with an almost interminable slowness, gradually sank. Night fell, and the sudden drop in temperature caused them to shiver uncontrollably, making it difficult when they stopped to light a fire from the sparse brush, using a flare to ignite the blaze and add a burst of heat. The self-heats were difficult to handle with their spasms, and precious water was spilled.
We have to try to sleep. Try to get as much rest as possible.
If I sleep, then I fear that I may never wake. If this is life, and more than a waking dream.
Nightmare, more like.
I have to get through this. There could be a veil just over the horizon.
Or a wag stop. Anything.
They all huddled together to keep warm and preserve valuable body heat. The rising sun woke them next morning, the lack of atmospheric cover causing the ultraviolet rays to immediately roast them. Mildred stirred beneath her jacket.
Another day, another adventure. I just hope that we find something today.
She let the sentence drift, not wanting to add that they didn't have the water and salt, even as carefully rationed as they dared, to last much beyond. And they had already passed the point of giving up the expedition, and all of them surviving a return trip. They began the slow march to the west, trudging heavily along the side of the road. The sun beat down steadily and with an ever-growing intensity, and after a few hours it was all any of them could do to keep their heads up. Ryan took the point, JB the rear, and they straggled out into a line, with Dean propping up Doc in the middle, while Christy and Jack followed close to the one-eyed warrior, with Mildred staying at the rear with the armorer. They couldn't bear to look up in the glare of the sun, and their aching neck muscles couldn't support them in their attempt to stare ahead, so it was the sound that came to them first, floating across the empty air and breaking the intense concentration that enabled them to keep one foot going in front of the other. It was Jack, with his heightened senses that made him such a keen hunter, who heard it first. Despite his fatigue, he snapped his head upright, red eyes burning brighter than the bloated orb above them.
People!
Ryan stopped, the line closing behind him as they banded together, coming to a halt. Jack's statement and Ryan's sudden halt instantly broke them from their own personal reveries. They all listened intently, staring as they did so into the shimmering haze that became more indistinct as it approached the horizon. There was no mistaking the sound. It was voices, at least 4 men, perhaps more, plus the sounds of hammering and some kind of work activity. Under the intense light, it was hard to make out, but there seemed to be some kind of building moving in and out of the edges of the haze, standing at the side of the old blacktop. It was too indistinct to see clearly, but it seemed obvious that this was from where the sounds emanated.
A wag stop. And people.
I don't believe it, even though I see it.
Let's get to it before we can't make it.
Don't know that they're friendly, though.
Good point. Triple red, but try not to let it show. We'll be a shock for them coming out of nowhere. No need to spook them more by looking ready for a firefight.
Ryan indicated that they move rather than speak, and the companions moved forward. The instincts that had kept them alive for so long enabled them to smoothly bring their favored blasters to hand and chamber shells in case they should need to fire on the human beings ahead. The first they had seen for days, the ones who could save them if they had water and food, and the ones who could give them shelter if they were friendly. And there was no guarantee of that in the Deathlands. No guarantee at all. The last 1,000 yards would be the hardest. It was a small cinder-built blockhouse, the adjunct to an old truck stop that had long since perished. The raised floor and foundations were all that remained, and it was on these remains that the men had their camp while they worked on the blockhouse. The roof had been removed and an upper story added. It was made of old sheets of corrugated iron, insulated against the sun by loose sheets of aluminum foil, which deflected the blazing sun from the iron, which would otherwise trap and magnify the intensity of its heat. The roof had been replaced on top of this, its sloping tiles giving the appearance that with one chem storm they could slide off at a bizarre angle. It was to this problem that the work party was now addressing itself. To one side of the blockhouse lay an abandoned site that marked an extension to the existing building, while the 8-strong work party was either on the roof itself or was swarming up and down the 3 ladders that stood at the sides of the building, unattached to the new extension. There were 4 more men. 3 were Sekh men, heavily built and wearing broad-brimmed hats to protect them from the worst ravages of the heat. They stood at points that covered the area surrounding the building. All held blasters, muzzles pointing down. 2 had Heckler & Koch G12 caseless rifles, while the 3rd was carrying an Uzi. All weapons appeared to be in fairly good condition. The 4th man stood out among the others. Standing at somewhere around 6'4 or 6'5, he was sparsely clad, with a loose cotton shirt open to the waist, loose cotton pants that ended around his shins, and leather-thonged sandals. He was slim, with the loose clothing hiding most of his body, but the open shirt revealed a tightly muscled chest and stomach. He had long, raven-black hair that fell in a single thick plait almost to his waist, the plait shot through with threads of silver gray that betrayed the encroaching middle age of its owner. On his head was perched a black stovepipe hat with a few oily feathers from a desert buzzard attached to the crown. The brim shaded his eyes, throwing them into shadow, and making the aquiline sweep of his nose and the thin, impassive set of his lips the only clues to his mood. He had walnut-brown skin, tanned and textured like supple leather, and his coloring betrayed his ancient Native American roots. Yet despite all this, the most striking thing about him was that he carried no blaster. Even the 8-man team swarming over the roof had hand blasters holstered and attached to their clothing. But this man, standing as still and silent as a ghost in the burning desert air, carried only a long-bladed knife of his own making, with a finely honed blade and an intricately carved handle that appeared to be of bone. The Sekh man, covering the area to the east, turned and hollered across the space between himself and the silent giant.
Yo, Crow! Y'all ain't gonna believe this, but there's a whole bunch of people walking out of the desert!
The giant said nothing, but the shout led to hilarity from the men working on the roof. A thick-set, heavily scarred man with sandy hair thinning on his scalp spoke up, not pausing in his task of rapidly resetting the thick asphalt tiles.
Shit! You've been chasing them desert mushrooms again, Petey.
Shut up, Hal. Just take a look-see.
The sandy-haired man stopped momentarily and looked up. Squinting into the desert haze, he could make out the straggling line of the companions as they slowly approached.
Well, I take it all back, Petey. Where in hell did they all come from?
He looked down to where the impassive giant stood.
Hey, Crow! Y'all hear that? And they got blasters out.
There was a pause, not long enough to denote that the giant was ignoring the exchange, but long enough to impose his sense of authority, something that was emphasized by the manner of his reply.
I heard. They'll all be exhausted. Must have walked for days, no matter which way they come. and they don't know if we're friendly folk. They'll be too exhausted to be a threat.
What you wanting me to do about them?
The giant spoke again without turning.
Let them come. Keep your blaster ready, but down.